Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and unfortunately, once again, I'm flying solo this week. Manny, get well soon. We miss you. I do, however, have our always colourful panel of commentators. Owner of Sunset Protection and the man that owes me lunch, John Perry. John, welcome.
With pleasure, Simon. Hey, let me arrange my teleprompter here. Good to be with you today.
Right. And from the wilds of Youngstown, Ohio, we have activist, author, and bar owner, Sam Murphy. Sam, hello.
Hey, hello, Simon, and happy Hanukkah to everybody in the listening audience.
And I want to point out to our audience that today is a truly unique event. We're in the final minutes of two vital football games. It looks like Cleveland Browns might extend their amazing winning streak to a solid 3 runs. What do you make of it, Sam? Is this the beginning of the end of the world?
I think the millions were right on. This is an incredible thing, and to think this streak started with a beating of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are also losing, but I'll let you fill in on that one, Simon. Just an amazing thing. People in Brownstown are just pinching themselves, and they hope the world doesn't come to an end. Well, actually, they do want the world to come to an end. On a good note, the Browns have won 3 in a row.
Well, this is what, like a 12 or more year record?
Yeah, for them, they haven't won more than 4 games. I think we're talking like five years. I think they've been like a 3-13, 2-14. I think 5 wins is the most they've had, and they'll equal that today because I don't think Kansas City's going to make a big comeback with 30 points down in the fourth quarter. I think they're at, right when I got on the phone, I think they were at, what's it called, 2-minute warning.
Wow. And of course, we have the infamous Chargers, who, surprisingly enough, must have had a change in their coaching staff because they appear to have figured out that there is actually a fourth quarter. and they're waxing the Steelers. I mean,
at Pittsburgh with Roethlisberger coming back is a pretty big victory for the Chargers. I have to tip my hat to them.
I'm surprised that they're even bothering. Usually, around about this time of the season, that they're more concerned about tee times at their favorite golf courses. Yeah, rather than actually playing football. But, hey, way to go. Also with us is well-known L.A.-based attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you all for having me. And the only thing I could think of during that whole intro was I just love the Cleveland Browns insignias on their helmets. They're my favorite.
Okay.
Well, they don't have any insignia. That's the thing.
Oh, aren't they all called a riddle? I've been making this study about what people have on helmets, and Mrs. Riddle obviously has a very large family because almost all of the helmets have the word riddle on them.
That's right, Dale. That's funny. That's good.
Not bad, not bad.
Okay, we have a a very wide-ranging program today, a veritable potpourri of topics. If you turn on any newscast, it doesn't matter which channel, which bias you like, they can't go 30 seconds without mentioning what likely will become the word of the year, fiscal cliff. We're just about 3 weeks away from this wonderful event, but maybe the Mayans will beat us to it. It's easy to get into the pissing match that's happening in D.C., and who should concede what. But I want to look at it from a slightly different angle. All three of you run small businesses, and I'm very, very curious to hear how the fiscal cliff might affect your business. Sam, I want to start with you, and I'm guessing here, but my guess is that you have the largest number of employees. I'm sure that you're still trying to dig your way out of the implications of Obamacare. How will diving off the fiscal cliff affect you and your company if it comes to that?
Luckily, I'm kind of, I hate to use the word exempt, but I'm one of those small businesses that doesn't, I fall right pretty much below the threshold that they set for mandatory health care and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, which is actually good. Where it's going to affect me is my employees are all going to get that 4% payroll tax back in. So that'd be, so that even though it's not a chump change, it really is. It's still a few bucks. It's still, you know, $100 for a month for the employees if you spread it out over 4.5 weeks. So that's going to hurt them. It's just another. It's just more taxes I got to pay. You know, I mean, in regards to that, and you know, so that's one aspect. The only other thing that I can see coming to the fiscal cliff affecting me will be I know there'll be. I had some people who are interested in buying my business. I think those talks are going to die. They will not be buying or selling because of the increase in capital gains. I don't even know if I'd want to sell right now for the huge hit I take on capital gains. So that kind of the deals have kind of fizzled out. I wasn't really looking to sell, but you know, someone you know started sniffing around. But the capital gains thing would kill me, so I'm not going to do that. And the other thing is that the taxes on medical devices coming January 2nd for Obamacare. I used to think that just meant devices for, you know, like you know, a pacemaker, an MRI machine, an X-ray machine, et cetera. But it actually goes all the way down to plastic gloves. Anything to do with medical, you're all going to have to pay more money on. Even a thermometer. For me, you know, you go, why does that affect me? Well, in our kitchen, we have to make next gloves. To a lot of them, especially on Mondays when we do wing day. And the price of that's going to go up, you know, because it's a medical device. I don't consider gloves a device, but the IRS does. So, you know, that's how it's going to affect me. A little bit on some things, not selling or not even looking to sell on the other, and that's it.
So basically what you're saying is sure, shove the trailer off the off the cliff, and you will survive.
Yeah, I mean, I will survive. My business will survive. I don't see it impacting. We don't have a lot of high end type people who come into the bar. I mean, I do have some people, you know, but I think a high end bars and restaurants where people go and drop the big bucks, like in the, you know, where Peter always meets Manny in L.A., with John, the New York City bars, the real fancy high-end places. If their high-end customers are going to taking it in the wallet, those places are going to take it in the wallet. Because, you know, people are going to save more. They're going to hoard. They're going to have to pay more. I also think of, you know, people go to buy and sell businesses, like I just talked about in mine. You're going to see people, the prices will go up because of the rise in the tax. So what you might be able to buy for as an investment for $15,000 today as a round figure is probably going to go up to $25,000 just so to cover the tax, the higher taxes. So those people that are into buying and selling things, you know, as capital gains go. So, yeah, and then, of course, will it affect me? Well, yeah, if we do go over the cliff, and as some people think we're going through, and they can't come together, all those things together it'll make Superstorm Sandy look like a sneeze, because it'll be a financial nightmare for everybody, not just the Arctic on the show. We'll all experience it. Well, it's going to be like that. It's going to be a different form of the meltdown in 2007 and 2008.
Yeah, you can bet your bottom line that FEMA won't be out there.
Brownie's not going to be doing a good job for us, you know. Yeah.
Right. John, I know not very much about your company, you know, other than that you have a predilection for large SUVs with, tinted windows.
Hey, we know a lot about you.
Right, yeah, people wearing dark suits. Well, I'm joking. Well, sort of. I mean, does the fiscal cliff, scare you? Will it affect your organization?
Simon, I think you know I don't play into this hysteria. I don't think it's the end of the world. As usual, I just see political entertainment and irony in it. Doesn't affect me at all. I'm not worried about it.
Perfect. Right. What? How about if they increase the tax rate on large black SUVs?
Mine's paid for. I'm not worried about it, Simon. Pay my bills. I'm a very conservative person, if you can't tell. I'll work within the system, and I like to think thrive, regardless of how difficult it is, even though I don't like an inordinate amount of paperwork.
Right. And Peter, I have no idea how large your organization is. But will inaction in the Beltway have a detrimental effect on Haven law?
I think what they do will have an effect on everybody in the U.S. somehow or another. It's unclear to me exactly how it will be. I'm kind of like John in terms of my approach to this. I don't see how it's really going to affect me. But I'm sure for me personally, it would have some sort of trickle effect, because I imagine, if the demand for legal services is like the demand for anything else, people make cost-benefit choices, and they don't want to buy anything they don't have to buy, and when the economy gets tighter or their wallets get pinched, they get even more tighter with respect to what they purchase, how much they're willing to pay, what they want to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But other than that, I can't see it affecting me. I can't imagine how I could be paying more taxes than I'm paying now. I feel like I'm already paying every conceivable tax there is. So it doesn't have a personal effect, at least none that I can see. But I'm sure if we do fall over the cliff, we'll all find out exactly how it affects us. And then maybe we'll all start screaming more at the people to get it resolved. But I do think that they're going to get it resolved. It's just like everything that I see in my life. I think, once you put some sort of deadline on it, and it appears that the deadline is pretty certain, then people really get together and try to solve it. And not until then. And so that indicates there'll probably be a last-minute solution to all of this.
Personally, I have an idea. I think the solution might be found by bringing in Tina Turner the movie set used in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. You know, we put Obama and Boehner, you know, together in the big cage, and everyone chants, "Two men enter, one man leaves."
I like it.
Sam, would you buy into that idea?
I wouldn't pay for it, but I like the idea. I didn't go pay to go see it, but I like the idea. You know, in regards to that, I think it's good. Personally, I'd rather have take all the politicians and everyone responsible for this, whatever industry or whatever media, whatever they may be, and open up a Devil's Island somewhere. We could build a wall around Youngstown and call it Escape from Youngstown, just to call the all the bums in a bigger prison and let them set for their own, like everybody else solve the problems. I think we're good. I am amazed that the Republicans, and that John, you must have been shocked when DeMint resigned and, you know, kicked off all the hardcore conservatives off the budget committee, were you?
I was not surprised at all, Sam. He's a man of integrity. He realizes it's nothing but a giant gab session. He's going to go somewhere where hopefully he can do some good.
Right, I understand that. And by all means, of course, he's left for the money. I mean, $1 million a year and no one calling up about constituent problems. But I think there's a bigger picture, though, is that Boehner, through all the hardcore conservative freshmen from the Tea Party, are plum post in the committees. One of them being Justin Amash, who was almost a libertarian, and I've followed him. And he's been bounced from his committee on the budget. And I think you're going to see, it will not surprise me if Boehner has a challenger for Speaker of the House and the Republican. So he's just, you know, in regards to, I still think he has the votes to win. But what I see Boehner doing is totally collapsing after the, you know, November massacre. And I think Obama's going to get almost 90% of everything, maybe even all of it, that he wants. And that would, you know, and that's still going to trigger to automatic spending cuts, which people don't realize, because these guys couldn't make a deal back in August. There's going to be a lot of things happening. I saw today, I didn't even know that was part of the fiscal cliff talk, maybe you guys saw it too, is that the unemployment insurance runs out for everybody. All those people have been on it.
I think it was extended.
The what?
I think it was extended again.
No, it's part of this deal. It has to be extended. It's part of the negotiations that are going on. It will end, and it won't be extended. That's another thing that they threw out that no one really ever knew about. So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of things out there. I hope that they get it together and they don't just kick the can down the road, raise up the debt ceilings, and here we are again in 6 more months. You know, I mean, I think that's what I most importantly want to see is a fair deal for everybody. And we're not kicking the can down the road again. And here we are come spring next year. And, you know, and hopefully there will be no other crisis that would affect that, like a war in the Middle East or something or that nature. But I just hope they get it done.
Oh, okay. On the same subject, but from a different angle, I was doing some reading this morning, and two sites, Salon and the infamous Huffington Post, have articles about everyone's favorite nut job, Ted Nugent. Let me quote just a little bit about what Ted has to say. The three sacred entitlement cows in the room that no politician wants to poke at are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. A blinding statement to the obvious is that we're never going to get our financial house in order until these sacred entitlement cows are not only poked but slaughtered. He goes on, yeah, as Ted loves to do. Nugent argued that instead of raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans, as many Democrats, including Obama, have supported, Congress should hike taxes on everyone, particularly the poorest 50% of Americans, whom Nugent accuses of mooching an insane free ride. The next step, wrote Nugent, was to suspend the right to vote of any American who is on welfare. Oh, now, who wants to take that one on?
John, you must be a bit of a Ted Nugent fan. How do you feel about that?
I love Ted Nugent.
I knew it. Now, we're not just talking about the music, right?
Oh, of course. He's a good American. I love the guy.
He's a great American. So go to his compound, wherever it is. If you can make it past the gun turrets, I'm sure he'll sit down and have a beer with you.
Probably some game I've never tried. Simon, I have a different take, but I'm not surprised you're reading those balanced rags, tools of the administration. I don't know what he said. I didn't see the article, but I think he shares some legitimate concerns that a lot of us do. I just see things differently than you guys.
Oh, okay.
Are you saying people on welfare shouldn't vote, John?
I don't know if he said that. That's a bit provocative. It might have been tongue-in-cheek. I don't know.
Ted Nugent never says anything tongue-in-cheek.
Simon, you got to develop a sense of humor.
I thought
Riddle was pretty good. That was a good one.
I don't know if he's I see totally different threats to the Republic, and Ted Nugent isn't one of them. He's just a citizen spouting off, like us.
All right, but if we assume that Ted Nugent's statement was true.
Because, Simon, you can't read inflection or intonation into an article, right?
You can when it's in quotation marks.
What I'm saying. You don't know the context, but go ahead.
All right. I mean, would you be in agreement that people on welfare shouldn't be allowed to vote? Yeah, they're effectively felons?
I not only think people on welfare should be able to vote, I think convicted felons, once they've paid their dues, should be able to vote. I don't agree with disenfranchising people who have done their time and gotten out. I think they should vote. But here's the way I see it, and maybe to piggyback on Ted's comments, I think this is what he's essentially trying to say, that the aim of the Democratic Party is to keep the populace in a constant state of alarm. And I know Ted from articles and seeing him on TV, he's a big fan of Orwell, which I would encourage everyone to see so you won't fall for these ploys. But the Democratic Party, it's always one emergency after another. Don't waste a crisis, like Rahm Emanuel says. So the people must be kept in a constant state of alarm and be led to safety, comfort, and ease by their omnipotent leaders, who, of course, know what's best. The masses, us, we got to be convinced that there's an endless stream of evildoers, say Ted Nugent, Mitt Romney, who are menacing our way of life. And here's what I find ironic, Simon, and you've got to admit this. Why is it over half the country is looking to the very people who got us into this mess to straighten it out? And what's the solution? To give these geniuses more money, power, and authority over our lives. And I think that's what Ted's trying to articulate.
Well, Well, I wish he would have said that instead of the way what he did say. That would have been
well,
trying to say, John.
Oh, I mean, to get boarded in the HuffPo.
Well, I agree with you. The HuffPo is the funny pages. I mean, it's the Fox News of the internet. No question about it. And as a matter of fact, Simon, you're really on that because you love to look at all the pictures of the girls, the jiggle that they have.
But
there's almost porn
Simon,
on that site.
Why aren't you guys more concerned about the very people who got us into this mess? Given more authority to solve.
Well, who are the very people who got us into this mess?
Well, you got the administration.
Which administration?
The Democratic. And
would that be a, quote, generic administration, John?
Well,
are you talking about
really
the eight years of the Bush administration, or what?
The Bush administration, Obama said it was unpatriotic that he added $4 trillion to the debt in 8 years, and Obama's added six in 4 years, and it's probably going to be 12. We're already at $16 trillion. That's, for those of you not familiar with math, that's a number with 12 zeros at the end and growing. And we're going to tell these guys, yeah, hey, solve our problems. Look to the government. And Ted's not like that. He's saying,
yeah,
accept responsibility, discipline, self-reliance, and don't rely on the government to solve your problems.
But, John, it just wasn't the Obama administration. As Peter and Simon pointed out, it's also the Bush administration.
Who criticized Bush?
Throwing Wall Street, okay, throwing Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and all the – I mean, there's a lot of people
okay,
people
Sam,
guilty.
But if Obama said – adding $4 trillion in 8 years is unpatriotic. What's
No, I agree with one thing. You said one very good thing, John. You said we are actually giving the people who got us into this mess more money and more power over our life. I agree with you on that. Whether it's Obama or Romney or whoever, they're the wrong people to be giving more money to. I do agree with you on that. But it wasn't just Obama's fault. I'm sorry, I can't go with that.
It was just
his
fault. But as far as the spending, he's Bush on steroids.
Yeah, because that's what he believes in. That's Keynesian government. They won, John. I mean, I hate that they won. Their concept of what it was going to take to win won. People believe. On one hand, I find it funny. The American people, was it Barnum who said you never could go broke underestimating the American people? Someone like that. I can't remember.
Was it John Lincoln?
Okay. On one hand, the American people have said to the government, stay out of our bedrooms. Stay out of our bedrooms. We don't have anything to do with it. Don't tell us about what we can do in our homes and all that. And I applaud that. But on the other hand, they also
get
the government.
It's not stay out of our bedroom. It's pay for our birth control.
But they want the government to do everything for them. I mean,
right.
You can't have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways, and that's the problem what we have. And in my opinion, that's what we have. We have a society that says, on one hand, it says, don't tell me about abortion. Don't tell me about if I can smoke pot. Don't tell me about it's okay for gay people to get married and all that sort of stuff. And then on the other hand, that same person goes, then they go to the government for more things. You want the government to take care of them, and it's just you can't do it that way. You have to be total personal freedom of everything is what I believe in, and let people make those decisions. Look, abortion is the law of the land. I wish conservatives would get off that, and then the religious right. It's been the law of the land. It's been the law of the land since 1972. As good conservative Republicans should applaud that. That's the law. They're supposed to be law-abiding citizens. Leave it alone and move on. I mean, that's a Supreme Court rule. And that's, and you're going to spend all this time trying to get 9 new justices or a new majority to make abortion illegal and bring back all that crap that comes with it. Who's going to take care of these kids? Who's going to feed these kids? Who's going to pay for these kids? And then you have the people going to get abortions in the back room doors. And there's a reason why it was made legal, and I don't understand, super-duper conservatives should not want the government telling people they can or cannot have abortions. And I wish it would go out of the American debate because it is the law of the land. And if you don't believe in abortions, then you could go move to a country where they don't have them and leave us alone. So we can focus on other issues.
I think the other part of this argument is what particular states are doing. Those states that are not in favor of abortions are making it virtually impossible for an abortion clinic to operate.
That's states' rights. Look at Washington and Colorado. They smoke in pot there now, or at least in Washington they are. It's legal, and that's great. Great for the state of Washington. They'll make more money. They'll distribute it, and of course, as we've always agreed, and it's good for Domino's Pizza. But every state, if that's what it has to be, and that's the way the founding fathers set it up. I mean, you know, when I had some great professors in college and teachers in high school and read some great books, and then you go back to the whole fundamental thing of states' rights, you know, was, hey, if the state of Washington wants to have legalized marijuana, that's what they're going to do. And those that don't want to smoke, if they don't like that in Washington, guess what? There's 49 other states they can move to, or 48, because Colorado.
Okay, Peter, you're a legal guy. Surely there is a bit of an issue here. You've got a situation where, you know, the federal government is saying one thing, and the state is saying another thing. And sure, you know, you can light up a joint in Denver or Washington State. But as I understand it, the DEA and the FBI are federal organizations rather than state-run organizations. Isn't there a clash?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and I think there is a clash and a bit of a clash, but I think they can manage it. I'd be curious to get John's thoughts on it. But, you know, if the state and the state's resources and the state's police personnel, if the state wants to say to police officers, look, no more busting guys for smoking marijuana. It's just not worth our time and effort and energy. And if they're not breaking any other laws, and if they're just sitting around puffing on a joint, then just leave them alone. Because we just don't want to invest in that fight. For whatever reason, the states decide that they don't want cops and prosecutors and everybody devoting any kind of attention to that at all. There's still federal rules and laws and regulations regarding drug trafficking, having drugs with the intent to sell them, possession with intent to sell, and the various drug trafficking problem. And I've always viewed, you know, the federal drug enforcement agencies as tackling the bigger overall drug trafficking problem. In theory, if the personal use of marijuana is legal in some states, then in theory, there should be some sort of legalized distribution of marijuana, you know, medical dispensaries or what have you. I don't know exactly how the mechanics work. So in theory, that should give the federal government less targets to go after. But if the federal government still thinks the war on drugs is a national war and it's going to continue to bust the importing of drugs, what I'm suggesting is that if it's legalized in some states, in theory, the importing of drugs should diminish to those states. At least that's the thought process behind it. So the federal government doesn't have to be concerned about that. But the feds can still go chase drug traffickers wherever they find them anywhere in the world, and they can still try to stop the illegal importation of drugs into the country to the extent that they perceive that as an issue. It is going to be interesting to see how these somewhat at odds approaches reconcile with each other and work themselves out. I'd be curious for your perspective, John, from a police enforcement perspective.
As far as the contrast between federal and state law?
Yeah, and how this will impact, boots on the ground, the cops on the ground who, aren't going to be spending their time busting guys for smoking a joint as long as that's all they're doing in some of these states.
I don't see that affecting the guys in the field. We really haven't enforced that for years, but you're probably aware, Peter, that local or state law enforcement doesn't even have the authority to police federal law. I know any time like I busted a counterfeit operation, I called Treasury, and that they had the call on the case. But
yeah.
I don't think there's anything to worry about because Holder's made it clear that he's not going to enforce or go after states who take a more lax view on any federal law. Look at the sanctuary cities. He never went after them for not complying with immigration law. The only state he went after is Arizona, who did want to enforce the law. So I think he's made it clear he has no interest in going after states who lower the threshold on federal law of any nature.
So you don't see it?
No, John, you got it wrong. I mean, he's going after states that are raising the bar, not lowering the bar.
That's what I'm saying. Like, for Arizona, who want to enforce immigration, he'll go after them. But lowering the bar, no. He didn't go after any sanctuary cities.
Right.
So and I'm sure the police for years have better things to do than arrest someone for smoking a joint. I doubt it goes on very frequently anyway, because that arrest would be left right out of the station.
I don't know about that. I know nothing about Ohio.
In Ohio, of course, the biggest thing they go after is the drunk driving and how many drinks you have and all that, being a bar owner and all that. And all that, and they keep lowering the blood alcohol level of that, because it's nothing but a moneymaker. And so for the attorneys lawyers really aren't practicing law anymore around here. They're just chasing after DUIs, divorces, and women's comp cases. I mean, how does anybody really practice law in the state? It's just all chasing after the easy bucks and that stuff. But in Ohio, local cops would cry like babies if they legalized marijuana, because there's a lot of busts that go, just like a DUI, they bust you for your joint, you pay a fine, your license, so you do all the same sort of stuff. So it's a big money maker for the state of Ohio, and I hope it gets legalized here. And I think Washington State is going to be the big incubator, because the way they set it up, they have one of the, I don't know if a lot of you know, but they have one of the oldest, they were the first ones that they had state control over the liquor after Prohibition. They set it up that way, where distribution centers and only certain distributors can distribute beer, wine, liquor, and whatnot. You go to the state store to buy it, whether you're a wholesaler or a retailer, and it spends that way. They're the ones, they put how this bill was passed by the people, they put the state liquor control system in charge of the distribution of marijuana, what you were talking about earlier, Peter. So the state of Washington is going to be buying marijuana or growing it or something, then the state will, the store will then sell it to people who want to buy it. And
right.
That's how they're taxing it, and with the tax monies and all that stuff. And I think that everyone's going to be watching to see, is that going to be cost effective? Is it going to return a lot of tax dollars to the wherever the money dedicated to go to, and how that's going to have an effect on it? And I think that's what Obama's going to do. I think they're going to keep the hands off approach and see if the state of Washington becomes flush with cash, because everyone smokes, lighten up a joint and whatnot, and there's no problems. A police officer friend of mine said the other day, is that in Ohio, that they're obsessed with, he's not a state highway control. He was talking about the state highway patrol, how obsessed they are with trying to find someone to get a DUI. So they just stare at everybody when they, you know, go by, and they have cameras, and they've got, you know, radar guns and all sorts of stuff in our state. They're everywhere. They're going on every street corner. But his question was, how are they going to determine if someone's high when they're driving?
They're just as impaired as anybody else, and if they show signs of being impaired by their driving, they get pulled over. It doesn't matter whether it's alcohol or weed.
So how do you do a test? Because marijuana stays in your system for months.
Well, that's a good question. I'm sure they can smell. I'm sure they can smell.
It's when you wind the window down and this big cloud of smoke comes out.
Yeah, I mean, a Cheech and Chong type trailer, yeah, I could see that. But
John, that's an interesting question. How do officers in the field test for that if there's a potential DUI issue? Can they test for that, to your knowledge?
It's subjective, Peter. Obviously, smell is the greatest indicator, but I'll say this. This is why it's so difficult. There's no gradations of intoxication for drugs. It's either positive or negative. You could have one puff, and under the law, you're going to be just as guilty as someone who's like Cheech and Chong, because they test if it's in your system. Alcohol, there's a level of intoxication. So obviously you're going to be at a higher level from two drinks to 10. But with drugs, there isn't. So it's either a yes or no. And it you don't want to take someone to jail, you know, because they had a puff of a joint. But legally you can, because they're going to test positive.
Well, it's an interesting issue.
Well, think about it. There's no way to measure the level of intoxication.
Well, there may not be any way to measure, but then again, why? Maybe there isn't. Maybe there's no need to have a way to measure. I don't know. Maybe the influence of smoking a joint is just bad enough in and of itself, and you shouldn't be operating a motor vehicle regardless.
And Peter, if a guy has a couple puffs on a joint, he might be intoxicated, let's say, to the equivalent of two beers. That's not impairment to me.
Well, that's interesting.
You could employ a fairly standard test. You know, if the person suspected of smoking marijuana calls you dude, that's the field sobriety test.
I used to ask them if they had hacky sack ankle.
Could always do a munchie test, right?
I think that, are you guys hungry? You want to get something to eat? I think that's great. You do a field sobriety test. You smelled marijuana. You saw redness in the eyes. You asked them if they had hacky sack ankle. Then you offered them to buy them food, and they jumped at the possibility. That's it. Slap the cuffs right on them right then and there.
Eat Cheetos in front of them.
Yeah, you want to know something?
I
think that would hold up in court. I think that's a good one.
But Peter, you see my point. There's no way to measure.
I think you raise a very good point, I think it's a very good point, and I think that it's something that the system will have to wrestle with and address. You know, a few years ago, everybody who wanted could text on their phone while they were driving, and then they realized that they couldn't do that, and they passed legislation against it. At least in California, they did. A few years ago, cell phones were everywhere. Now, in theory, you're supposed to have hands-free devices. A few years ago, you didn't have to wear a seatbelt. Then they finally realized that you had to wear a seatbelt. I'm confident that the system will be able to address this concern if it, in fact, dramatically increases the incidence of driving while under the influence of marijuana. All it's going to take is a few accidents that are directly attributed to marijuana use, and then everyone's going to start screaming. And something will be done. I'm confident the system will be able to address it. Right now, you raise a very good point. It's not an easily addressable thing, and I don't know if it's going to change much, given that in some jurisdictions, apparently, you can smoke a joint, and there are probably people out there who think, well, that means I can do anything while I'm smoking marijuana, and then they'll start driving. And, you know, boom, we'll see what happens.
Well,
I don't think
there's the bigger question. You know, you have a stressful job, so your idea of getting through the day is to have a joint, you know, with your morning coffee, you know, before you hit the office. I mean, where's that going to stand?
I have concerns about. I think marijuana stays in your system a lot longer than alcohol,
yep.
And I think if you're constantly replenishing it on a regular basis, I think you're arguably going to be very much under the influence of it for a longer period of time than alcohol. Alcohol, in and of itself, is problematic enough. But I think that you're going to see impairment if people view this as a carte blanche to start engaging in behavior. You know, according to what we've talked about before, most people think that people are engaging in this behavior already. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not, I don't know. But if people start overindulging and overusing and becoming impaired, they're going to suffer in other ways. If they can't function at work, if people constantly smell marijuana smell on them at work, they may have even suspected it before, but if they constantly smell it on them at work, they're going to start associating those people with screw-ups and mistakes. I think that if they start driving and they increase their use, I think they're going to run afoul of DUI laws regardless of detection issues. I think it's just going to take an incident or two before somebody slaps the cuffs on them. I don't know exactly. Go ahead.
Okay, the absolute prime example I can think of is someone employed as a short haul, you know, delivery driver.
Running delivery.
No, something bigger than that. You know, but short haul, as in.
Airport shuttle driver.
No. Freight going to going to stores. You know, delivering whatever it might be. You know, lettuces or
hostess.
You know, tomatoes or hostess. All right. The feds are pretty tough on commercial drivers. You know, the need for logbooks and all the rest of it. How on earth are companies going to deal with this situation?
Well, I'm not sure what we're talking about here. If you're talking about interstate commerce, that's typically not a federal issue. If you talk about intrastate commerce, crossing state lines, then that immediately becomes a federal issue. But I still go back. You know, if you have a guy who's driving a grocery store delivery truck and he's making deliveries, I don't know, in some region within a state, and I think you're suggesting that he's smoking in the morning, or maybe he's smoking in his car as he's driving. If he's transporting bigger amounts of drugs with an intent to sell or distribute those drugs, I think that's going to get federal attention. If he's using individual amounts of drugs in the morning or in his vehicle or what have you, then it's an under the influence question, and it seems to me, if it shows that he's under the influence and he gets involved in anything, he's going to have trouble. And I do think that customers, if he smells like marijuana when he comes in to deliver the product, I think they're going to start reporting him. And I think they're going to say he seems like he's under the influence. He seems like and companies are going to say, well, I don't know if we really want to portray that image. And I don't know if we really want a guy, even if he's not doing anything against the law, I don't think we want a guy delivering stuff smelling like marijuana smoke.
John, do you ever turn up on jobs smelling of marijuana?
Oh, you're killing me. For obvious reasons, I don't smoke weed. I don't like it. But I'm not judgmental. I know a lot of people who do, and I really couldn't care less. But I would say your scenario, Simon, if your employee's driving your company truck, you can require drug testing.
Yeah.
It's the same on a job where you have to operate heavy machinery. I know people at the L.A. Times who have lost fingers because they were intoxicated. And I've actually stopped L.A. Times delivery guys who were, well, they could drive better than they could walk. And I guess when you have a job every day like that where you have to deliver the paper at 3, 4 in the morning, it might be tough not to drink. But it's already going on. I don't think it's going to change at all. But I would just say companies need to safeguard and protect themselves in case this guy gets in an accident because they're going to get sued.
Yeah.
But with the legalization, the greatest probably drawback I see is a drop in productivity of the employee. But I don't really see it as, unless you're operating heavy machinery or driving or something like that, is impairing, because I don't know if you guys have been around painters, but that's a notorious profession for smoking weed, and they would tell me, well, we inhale paint all day, what's worse? So you're absolutely right.
Well, I think we're gonna eventually, you know, Peter said a lot of systems gonna, you know, first with seatbelts, you know, required, and you know, originally people didn't wear them, and all the things that the law enforcement has done and government's done to make us, quote-unquote, safe on our vehicles and whatnot, we're going to reach a point where the only thing you're going to be able to drink is NyQuil and drive.
No, that has alcohol in it too, Sam.
That's about it. But that's about it. You know, everyone drinks something.
Don't suggest that to people, because I've also seen people impaired on NyQuil, believe it or not.
Oh, sure. You know, I can think of another interesting scenario here, my legal mind spinning. You know, at some point, if people start overindulging now or start engaging in behavior that makes it obvious that they're smoking, the stuff John points out is very true. I mean, if you're operating equipment and machinery and you have other lives at stake, the company can absolutely, you know, try to test you and monitor you, and they can discipline you or fire you for those grounds. But it's interesting to me to think about if you have other jobs that don't involve, you know, putting people at risk. I'm thinking of, like, you know, every big building you see in every downtown skyline, there's all kinds of internal mail delivery that goes on, and there are guys pushing carts up and down those buildings, dropping off mail at desk after desk after desk after desk after desk. And, you know, what happens when companies start saying, you know, we've noticed you've been smoking marijuana and we're going to fire you? And, you know, to me, that those people in states that have legalized marijuana may have claims. And it'll be interesting to see how those claims come about. Those people say, you can't fire me. I'm not doing anything illegal. I think the employers can still fire them, and I think the employers will probably prevail in those claims. But I do think you may see additional lawsuits filed on behalf of people who are terminated, reprimanded, or otherwise disciplined for smoking marijuana, even in a so-called non-hazardous position, because I still think the stigma of it and the fact that companies don't want it in the workplace is still just going to be as strong and prevalent as ever.
Hey, Peter, you should give your phone number about now.
Well, I should, except that I don't think those lawsuits are going to have much merit. I think they're going to be brought. I think you're going to see them. I think people are going to start getting fired or disciplined or reprimanded or whatever, and then you're going to start seeing lawsuits. That's not something I'm interested in doing. I don't think those are particularly meritorious claims, because I do believe employers have the right to do that. But, yeah, it would be a good pitch if I was interested in doing that kind of thing. Smoke law.
Can I break in? I've got to go. I have a Hanukkah dinner I have to go. I want to wish everybody, thank you for the hour's time and the great talk conversation. I enjoyed listening to everybody. I hope everybody has a great week, and happy Hanukkah to everybody. And we'll talk to you guys next Sunday, because we still have a week to go before the Mayan calendar.
Go Brown.
Have fun.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay. What I was about to say was, you know, an employer has the right to demand certain things from their employees. You know, Sam, hang the phone up.
Sam left the call but didn't hang the phone up.
Right.
Well, the lunch I'm going to be getting under test for right now is about
the Sam. Hello, Sam. Sam. Oh, Lord. He's having a great time.
Maybe he's high.
What, Jeff?
You're right. I am going to unceremoniously dump him.
Jonathan, I emailed a private YouTube video about Finland.
Okay. All right.
Did we lose poor Sam?
Yeah.
Good.
Unceremoniously dumped.
Hey, but, Simon, let me ask you a quick question. This was funny. I want to – only you can answer this. It's a little off topic, but this happened to me years ago. You ready?
Sure.
All right. I stopped this guy. His windshield was like a spider web. You couldn't even see out from the driver's side. And he had Mississippi plates. And I never wrote tickets, so I actually was concerned that this was a hazard. So I stopped him, and I said, why don't you get your windshield fixed? He says, well, I didn't think it was that important. I said, you can't even see out the window. You got to stick your head out. And he says, well, I'm from Mississippi, and everyone in Mississippi has a busted windshield. I said, I couldn't think of a retort to that. So I said, I never been to Mississippi. Maybe you're right. Go ahead. Because I couldn't dispute it. So is that true, Simon? I was wondering all these years.
Nah, not strictly true.
So he played me. Okay.
Okay. I want to change subjects. And hit one that we've discussed before. Press bias. And John, don't get scared. I'm not gonna pick. I'm not gonna pick on your
Simon,
favorite.
Please. I enjoy it. I want to live up to your expectation.
All right. Last Sunday, after we had concluded our program, Bob Costas made some remarks about gun control.
Right.
At the halftime show, obviously, I don't think that was the best venue, but should he get fired for it?
No, Simon, I don't like to call for the fire on anybody, and what I don't like is the double standard. I've known Bob Costas was to the left of the salad fork for years, and I haven't listened to him in 5 years, me and my friends, but I'm politically savvy. Most people don't even realize it. But if people want to listen to him, I got no problem with it. He's got a right to earn a living. I don't like the double standard. I remember a few years ago, Rush Limbaugh was fired for some comments. He was called a racist, and Hank Williams was taken off Monday Night Football. And all he did was sing a song, the intro. He didn't even provide commentary. But you got to let people have their opinion, and if there's a market for it, more power to him. I was a little depressed that he would quote someone like Jason Whitlock, who I remember during the Lin Sanity craze, you know, Jeremy Lin in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He actually said, he tweeted, I think, that, I'm paraphrasing, but as I recall, he said something to the effect, there's going to be some lucky lady in New York City who's going to be in for 2 inches of fun tonight. You guys remember that.
I love reading Whitlock. I miss that one. That's funny.
Okay, but if you're going to indulge in that kind of humor, which I think there is a venue for it. I'm not saying the guy's racist. I don't know him. But you can't have a double standard. Just because the policy or person you like might be offended by it, that doesn't make it okay or not okay. You got to be consistent. And I just would like to see some consistency in allowing people to voice their opinion. I wouldn't even mind seeing you on the show, Simon. You're a pretty funny guy. We disagree, but I like listening to you.
Well, you know, I had no objections to what Bob Costas had to say.
I totally disagree, but I'm not going to silence a critic.
All right, it made perfect sense to me, but let me guess, and I haven't been snooping. John, I'm pretty sure you're a gun owner.
I'm a member of the NRA.
Perfect. Sam, I'm pretty sure you likely have a gun.
He left.
Oh, didn't we cut him off?
Yeah, I cut him off. And Peter, it wouldn't surprise me one iota if you had a gun. But it's got nothing to do with it. Should a sports commentator make comments at halftime about gun control?
You know, I'm gonna quote another sports figure in this context because I do think it's applicable. One of my favorite sports figures of all time was a coach by the name of Jimmy Johnson, and you all probably remember him. And Jimmy he liked to have his players at attention at team meetings, and there was a linebacker one day who fell asleep in one of the team meetings, and Jimmy Johnson cut him that same day. He cut him. And one of the reporters, this was when Jimmy Johnson was running the Dallas Cowboys, and one of the reporters said, "Well, coach, what would you have done if Troy Aikman was asleep in a meeting?" And Jimmy, and I just love this quote, Jimmy said, "I'd walk up to him and I'd tap him on the shoulder and I'd say, Troy, can you please wake up?" And the point of this little story is that I'm afraid double standards are somewhat inevitable, and that you know, there's a reason to the so-called madness. Some people have the ability to make these comments and quote unquote get away with them in particular contexts, in particular circumstances. In the case of Bob Costas, you know, he's a veteran TV a sports commentator. He's been commentating on sports for years and years and years, and he has an editorial program where he has sports documentaries and sports things. So he has kind of crossed over into the realm of an editorializer regarding sports, a documentarian regarding sports, and also he got his start as a play-by-play commentator for NBC many years ago. And, should he be able to do this? There was an obvious interplay between sports and guns on this particular instance, and it's not the only time that sports, and in particular the NFL and guns, have gotten involved with each other. There are numerous incidents all the time that link NFL players with guns and problems with guns. And I'm not sure I agree with his comments about how gun control would have prevented this incident. I don't know enough about the incident to speak to that issue, but I personally don't feel that it was out of place. Now, John, you make a very good point. You referred back to, Rush Limbaugh back on, I'm pretty sure that was the maybe that was ESPN NFL Countdown or something. I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
He was on one of the networks, and he said something about Donovan McNabb. But
yeah, he made a comment about Donovan McNabb, and that was ESPN's NFL Countdown. And,
okay.
And you know, sports commentators, sports programs are always trying to do what you say you like, John. They're trying to get entertaining.
Right.
And so they have these crazy guys who appear in their programs who have no business being talking about sport. Before it was Rush Limbaugh. Who was that comedian they got to do Monday Night Football games for about a year?
Guy
with a beard.
I love Dennis Miller.
Dennis Miller. Okay, well, Dennis Miller was great, but I used to listen to him on Monday Night games, and it used to just kind of drive me nuts. I didn't want to hear him. Anyway, what Rush Limbaugh said was this. Rush Limbaugh came on, and he's on a panel, and on that panel are two or three ex-African-American football players. Tom Jackson is the most notable one that I can think of right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Rush Limbaugh basically said that the only reason we thought so highly of Donovan McNabb, who at the time was the starting quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, who were a Super Bowl contender, was because he was black. And that was the only reason that we gave him any attention at all. And if he was white, he'd be considered a mediocre quarterback. And you know, some of the guys on the panel were totally taken aback by that. They felt embarrassed and they didn't know how to respond, and they kind of just, you know, they couldn't do anything. And I think one guy on the panel took him to task for it. It might have been Steve Young or Howie Long. I don't remember. But, you know, within 48 hours, they fired Rush Limbaugh. And ESPN fired Rush Limbaugh because ESPN said, basically, that we didn't like this comment. We didn't like it. And, you know, that's the price you pay when you want to open your mouth and make an opinion. You got to know your setting. You got to know your environment. You got to know the market. You got to know the audience. And most of all, unfortunately, you got to live with the consequences. That's part of freedom of speech. ESPN has a right to engage in whatever speech it wants to engage in within reason, and they don't want to promote this speech. And they probably have a lot of reasons for it, including marketing and the fact that the NFL, you know, it draws dollars and interest from a number of African-American fans and blah, blah, blah. You know, 10 years after the comment was made, 15 years, whatever it is, many people would probably say, you know, maybe Rush Limbaugh was saying something that was somewhat accurate. At the time, it sounded like utter blasphemy. I mean, I just heard it and I just thought it sounded crazy. And it turned out within 24, 48 hours after making this comment, Rush Limbaugh was admitted to a hospital for overusing and becoming addicted to painkillers within a very short period of time after making this comment. You know, so I don't know if it's a double standard. I don't know where the line is or what the line is, what should be done or not done. But the bottom line is you have to live with the comments you make. And if your employer decides in a public setting that he didn't like the comments you make or that you got a little out of bounds, you can be fired. And we see that happening all the time, every single day. And it doesn't mean these people lose their First Amendment rights. It just means that other people don't want to hear them. And it's just a case of picking and choosing. And it seems to me that happens every day in every news program and every sports program and everything we watch on TV. People in one form or another are engaging in some type of editorializing or opinion stating, so to speak.
But, you know, it's one thing, you know, grumbling about a player on the field. It's entirely a different deal, you know, talking about the suicide and death of someone else, and talking about gun control. I loved his comments, but it didn't seem the right time nor place.
Well, you know, I don't know. I didn't hear his comments. I heard about them. And what I immediately thought was to myself, well, first of all, I thought, well, I wonder if that's true. Would gun control have really affected this incident between, you know, the Chiefs player and his girlfriend, mother of his child? And I just don't know enough about it to say one way or another. Let me ask you this question. Do you think gun control would have had any impact at all on the massacre in Colorado where that poor crazy bastard was buying guns on the internet and was arming himself to the teeth and then dressed up like the Joker and went in and shot people up with semi-automatic weapons on the night of the Batman premiere. I mean, to me, it seemed like some modicum of gun control might have had an effect on that incident. I don't know if it would have had an effect on this Javon Belcher incident, but it does seem to me to be topical, even remotely. And, you know, I just don't know if I have a real problem with him talking about these issues. I think he's going to have to live with the consequences of it, and maybe ratings went up, maybe ratings went down, maybe somebody called him in and said, you know, Bob, we love you, we wish you wouldn't talk like this. You know, the equivalent of tapping him on the shoulder and telling him not to fall asleep in meetings. I just don't know.
Okay. What I see is that every single time that there is a high-profile news story concerning murder by guns, we hear the same thing, that the gun lobby say, oh, now is not the time to discuss it. So when is the right time?
Well, I don't know. It seems like it's always an appropriate topic to discuss, and we've been discussing it all the time. As soon as you start talking about Ted Nugent to start the broadcast, where the first thing I think of is that guy's probably armed to the teeth. And, you know, I don't know what could be done about it, but it certainly seems to me like it's a topic always worthy of discussion, and almost at every moment.
John, you've been remarkably quiet. I know that you have guns.
Submarine raid, Simon.
But, and that doesn't bother me.
Oh,
you know,
thanks.
I'm pretty certain that not even your you know, longest reaching gun can reach me in Mississippi. But I look at this constant back and forth. I see news stories involving guns, and this same old tired argument. You know, now is not the time to talk about it. So when is the right time to
talk
about it?
Well, I think they mean when emotion's involved. But I have a couple quick comments, and I'll get back to your question and expand if you want. But something for Peter to consider, saying Bob Costas has the gravitas to comment on political issues. I don't think that's it at all. It doesn't matter who the messenger is. It matters the content. Consider if he came out against gay marriage, if he would be afforded that same venue.
He might very well lose his job. I mean, it seems to me that's happened recently.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with anything else. It's the content. He can audition to become a commentator on MSNBC on halftime of football, if that's what he wants to do, as long as it comports with acceptable ideology, where there's only one right opinion, and that's the one he happens to hold, like on many issues of the left. There's no debating it. But I would say, Simon, look at the facts. Wherever they have the strictest gun control laws, highest crimes of gun use. And I can tell you from working the street, there's nothing a crook fears more. Not the police, not anybody. They fear an armed citizenry, and it's a great equalizer for women and the elderly. And look at the statistics. Take Chicago, the murder capital of the country right now. Strictest gun control standards. Crooks don't follow the law. So the only people who do are the law-abiding citizens, and they won't buy a gun to protect themselves. So look at common sense and statistics, and I would say in Colorado, if I were in that theater, lives might have been saved, and maybe my own cost, but I would have exchanged fire with the individual and had a fighting chance.
Now, John, would it have been, and I'm just asking it out of curiosity, would it have been legal for you to bring a firearm into the movie theater in Colorado at that time?
Yeah.
But why would that have been, I mean, is it because you have
ago, there was a law passed, I think it's 215, that allows police officers to carry in any state in the union.
Okay, so a police officer can carry a concealed weapon into a crowded movie theater, blah, blah, blah. That's no problem.
Right.
But if you, if I was a private citizen, would it have been legal for me to pack my firearm and go to that movie theater in Colorado?
Oh, I don't – you mean in California if you live
well,
there?
Well, let's just – I mean, you know.
No, you would have to get a permit in Colorado.
But a permit to own a gun – let's just say I got it. I mean, in my mind, in California, there's a distinction between a permit to own a gun and a permit to carry a gun as a concealed weapon.
Yeah,
now,
let's just say
California. Could I, if I had a permit to own a gun, would it be legal for me to carry it into the movie theater with me?
You have to have a concealed carry permit.
Yeah, okay. And I'm just curious, how do you get that? What do I? How many courses do I have to take to get that?
Well, the police chief in the area you live, which I think you would be LAPD, he would have to authorize it. So I would suggest contributing to his campaign coffers.
Is it really like that, or is he really supposed to make that decision based on some sort of pseudo-law enforcement function?
Well, basically they say if you need it. And it's not enough to say, well, my job as a security guard, because they're not going to grant it for that. You have to be like the victim of a violent crime.
You have to feel you're under some sort of threat or something.
Or like transport jewelry, like down at the mart. Something where you can show that you need it for personal protection when you're engaged in your daily activity.
Well, you know, you raised some, I'll be honest with you, John, you raised some very good points. Let's start with the Constitution. You framed your statement very well, and I'm assuming you're mindful somewhat of what the Constitution says. And the Constitution says the right of the people, the right of the citizenry to bear arms is very important, and therefore the right of states to the right of a citizenry to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed by the federal government. And that's basically you know, what was intended by the framers to be an issue of protecting states from the federal government, because that's the characterization in which the
did you see that story, that case in Texas where that home invasion burglar was corralled and locked himself in his car because the homeowner had a gun?
You raise a good point. I'm sure criminals do fear guns, and I think we've gotten to the point now where I'm honestly legitimately concerned every time I walk around. I feel like I'm in a room full of people who are packing. And,
well, Peter, I got to tell you, if I were a crook, I'd move to a blue state.
Well, you could say stuff like that, blue, red. You know, to me, it doesn't seem to really matter. One of the reasons
it does
that
in
state,
Texas, don't mess with them.
Okay, that's great. Don't mess with Texas. That's fine. I mean, I think that's probably a state where everybody's probably packing weapons all over the place. I went to a party once in L.A. at somebody's home. And I encountered some guy, and, you know, he seemed a little off to me, and he was boozing it up and getting drunk. And, you know, he admitted to me that at that moment he had, like, about six different firearms on him.
Six?
And, I mean, he said he had one in his sock. He said he had one under his jacket. He said he was packing one here. I mean, he was a little off. And not within two minutes of making this statement to me, some guy came up to him and said something totally innocuous, and this guy grabbed him by the throat and threw him up against a wall, and we had to pull him off. And all I could think was, this guy's going to blow my head off just for trying to pull him off this guy. He was whacked. Okay, now, You raise a very good point. I mean, I have to admit, I actually am concerned. I think there are so many people out there packing firearms that I'm actually not even sure what to do about it anymore, and I'm seriously considering buying guns. And I don't own guns. I grew up with guns. I fired guns when I was younger. I lived out in the country, and they weren't a big deal to me. I fired shotguns and rifles and handguns, but I never in my life felt like I had to start packing heat. And now I actually start thinking seriously about buying guns because I feel like everybody's got them.
And that's and the reason, not because of the crime rate?
I don't fear, you know, I got to tell you, I fear more an incident like a Colorado. I fear more an incident like the one I just described at a party. I mean, I feel like when I drive my car, if I honk my horn the wrong way, the guy in front of me is going to turn around and put a hole in my windshield. I'm not really worried about a guy coming up to me on the street and trying to rob me. You talking about the Van Nuys shootout with the bank?
No, the Van Nuys at Van Nuys Court. A friend of mine's the one who jumped on the guy. He came out of divorce court and was firing at his wife's attorney, who was hiding.
Yeah, well, there's a good example. So, I mean, you may not be aware of this, but about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, Van Nuys Superior Court, they had it captured on a news video camera, some big fat lawyer came out of the court and some former client or some affiliation of some type confronted him with
the representing his wife in divorce.
Okay, so that's what it was. So he didn't like the lawyer, hated the lawyer, and he chased the lawyer around a tree, and they did this thing. But he shot him once or twice, and I think the lawyer lived. He was a big guy, I remember. Well,
I saw the video.
I tell myself every day, you know, people live in the illusion. I can't tell you how many times I hear this. People say to me, "Oh, they can't do that. They can't do that." And I say to people, what are you talking about? These people can do anything they want, but that's against the law. That would break the contract. That's this, that's that. And I remind them that there's nothing to stop anybody from doing anything they want at any time they want.
Right.
There are consequences to be paid, but don't be a fool. Don't live in a world where you think that this isn't going to happen. You know, I see people yelling at staff and waiters and waitresses. I see people screaming at other people in cars, and they all act with the illusion that that they're perfectly safe and that the law protects them. And, you know, I don't play that game. I try not to ever go.
Well, Peter, that's called maturity.
I try not to ruffle anybody's feathers because I have no idea who's packing a gun or who's not. I don't fear somebody robbing me for money. I don't fear someone breaking into my home and trying to steal my laptop or my television. What I really am concerned about is walking around on the street, and for some reason I get caught in crossfire, or somebody just goes crazy, or you know, they think I'm the evil image of everything they hate in the world, and they pull out a gun. Or I see some other people being victimized, and then I feel like I have to try and help them or something. And it's an increasing concern, and at this point, I'm almost ready to start signing up for gun classes tomorrow and buying guns.
I actually think you have a better chance of winning the lottery than that ever occurring to you.
Well, you say that, but yet I've already been in proximity with people who have firearms, and I hear about stories like, for instance, Plaxico Burress.
Mm-hmm.
He walks in with a loaded gun, shoots himself in the thigh. You know, that happens in a restaurant in New York. You know, the gun accidentally goes off. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Was
I feel like
the
they're
pony
all packed.
Like Sy?
Pardon me?
Was he doing the pony like Sy?
I don't know what he was doing. He told police that it slipped and he grabbed it and he had it in his belt. Put under his belt, and it slipped, and he grabbed it, and it went off. I mean,
was involved.
You know, would a gun protect me from that? I don't know, but what really concerns me is that what if Plaxico gets really angry in that restaurant and he decides to pull out a gun? Look at Javon Belcher. I mean, obviously, you know, I he obviously had mental illness and mental problem, and he committed murder.
Yep.
And, you know, who knows when that's going to happen. And that thing in Colorado is just, quite frankly, terrifying. I mean, that guy is, in my opinion, clearly insane. And he went in there like a one-man army into a movie theater, and everybody was defenseless. And, yes, if we're fortunate enough to have an armed and licensed John Perry in the crowd, that would be great. But we can't count on that.
True. Look at Virginia Tech.
Look at Virginia Tech. I mean, these stories happen all the time, and I don't know what can be done about them. I honestly don't know at this point. It just seems like it's a hopeless mess to me, and I don't see any way of solving it, because we're never going to get the guns out of the population now. But, you know, it is a concern for me when I'm a guy who thinks that having a lot of guns around creates the potential for problems, and now I'm starting to think, like, well, I got no choice. I got to start packing heat, too. Otherwise, it's just crazy.
But remember, a lot of crooks aren't going to burglarize your house thinking you might have a gun. You take away guns, that fear will be removed.
Well, you know, I think people burglarize homes because they think that there's some good, ill-gotten gain to be acquired there. And I think that when people burglarize homes, I think they try to do it at a time when they expect to encounter no one. That's my theory. I don't know. You know, I'm not a burglar, but it just seems to me if I was going to rob somebody's home, I'd do it when no one was around, and I'd do it because I thought there was something in there I really wanted.
If you see a house that says protected by Smith & Wesson, you might hit the neighbors.
Well, maybe, but if you see a house that says protected by ADT or some security system or something, doesn't that give you the same incentive? I don't know.
Yeah, that could too.
I mean,
deterrent, but not everyone can afford an alarm.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
All right, John. Am I correct in this theory that you would prefer that everyone packs a gun rather than no one packs a gun?
I can't make that blanket statement, Simon. I would say law-abiding, sane people, yes.
Okay. So how do we determine the law-abiding folks?
Well, you can do background checks. That's a start.
Okay, and how well has that worked?
Pretty well, as far as I know. There's millions of people who own guns, and look at the small incidents of actual law-abiding citizen using it, as opposed to a crook who doesn't care.
Okay. What about automatic and semi-automatic weapons? That they're not terribly useful for hunting purposes. Should they be available at Walmart?
Well, I mean, I have a semi-automatic handgun. If you're talking like AK or something. What are you talking about?
Does that function well? I mean, doesn't the kick spray the bullets everywhere? Do you get pretty good control and accuracy with that, John? I'm just curious. No,
yeah.
I'm really seriously curious. The problem with handguns is that they're less accurate than rifles or something like that. But
not at a short distance. They're accurate up to at least 25 yards.
How about those so-called, and I hate the expression, but they were armor-piercing bullets, Teflon-piercing bullets, and, you know, they call them cop-killer bullets. And what about those? Are people buying those?
I don't know. I'm really not a gun enthusiast. I have it for my own protection and for my job, but I'm not an expert by any means. I don't shoot Bambi. I'm not a hunter. I never will be. I don't see why someone would. To me, the challenge is those guys go out with a bow and arrow to try to hunt. That's a challenge. I don't see the challenge in taking a semi-automatic rifle to go kill animals. But,
okay. You've said the word. All the words. All right. Would you be objecting to semi-automatic and or automatic rifles being made illegal?
That's tough, Simon. I don't have, like I say, I haven't devoted a lot of time to the issue. Myself, I wouldn't have a problem with it, but I'd certainly be willing to listen to Ted Nugent if he wanted to convince me.
if you going with that, there's no doubt in my mind that Ted would convince you that that would be the craziest idea on earth, to outlaw semi-automatic weapons. And furthermore, you talk about law-abiding citizens. I feel very confident that if they declared a law that said everybody had to turn in all of their semi-automatic weapons, I'm pretty sure Ted Nugent wouldn't do it. Maybe I'm wrong in that, and I apologize, but I just don't think he would. He doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who would give them all up. To me, it just seems like I don't know what could be done about this anymore.
You guys are worrying about the wrong thing. As we speak, 50 kids are being murdered in Chicago a month, and you're worried about guns in the hands of Ted Nugent, who's not going to kill anybody.
I'm not convinced that Ted Nugent isn't going to kill anybody. He talks a lot about being an alpha male, and he talks a lot about survival of the fittest. But be that as it may, you're suggesting that the problem with kids getting killed with guns can't be helped in some way by controlling guns, and I'm not sure that's right. I don't know.
It isn't working in Chicago, is it? And no one.
Well, you say it isn't working. I don't know what the problem's going to be like if they just say anybody can own a gun, no problem. I mean, I don't know.
I don't see how it could be much worse.
Well, you might be right about that. I just don't know. Guns are just pervasive and everywhere now. And
don't
you
think our attention's being diverted to the people who actually are no threat when people are dying on the streets? And I've seen it nightly. No one even cares. I don't get it.
Well, those to me are separate problems, and you're quite right. It just seems to me it's kind of a scary world. It's a scary world when anybody can own a gun, because quite frankly, I don't think most people are fit enough, mature enough, or competent enough to really be in possession of firearms.
Well, what's the first action of a totalitarian?
Yes, kill all the lawyers. Yeah, well, it's hardly a totalitarian state to say that we're going to regulate who can control guns. I don't think that's really a legitimate fear, but, you know.
That's the first thing they impose in countries.
Okay, then there you go. Then, so forget it. Everybody gets to have a gun then, because we don't want to be a totalitarian state. Who cares how many people die?
We have to show fidelity to the Constitution, not just the amendments you like.
Well, I think the constitutional amendment in question, unfortunately, it's ambiguous. I think it was meant to give the states the right to keep and bear arms, which is what it says. The right of the states to keep and bear arms being important to well-established democracy. The government shall not infringe the right of citizens to have firearms is basically what it says. And, that's the language. That's the Constitution. I don't know whether the ambiguity was intentional or unintentional, but that's what it says. It seems to me we regulate who can drive a car, but we regulate who can drive a car more so than we regulate who can own a gun. And to me, the world seems like a more scary place. The more guns you put into the
society. How's that working out? More people die in car accidents than gunshots.
I think a gun's a deadly weapon. That's all there is to it. I think there should be some modicum of regulation and control over it, but I don't know what type of regulation or control to implement at this point, and I'm concerned that there's no ability to stop it at all.
Peter, I hope
so
we don't
you
see
win,
the day.
You win, John. You win. Everybody gets a gun. You win.
I hope we don't see the day where you're going to demand I pedal my Schwinn down the 101.
I don't think, my views on cars are very different than that. I'm more concerned about their ecological impact than that.
But
I think the future of cars, John, is that they're going to be driverless. Well, you can laugh about that, but they're building networks of driverless cars that run on computers, and they're perceived to be safer and more ecologically sound. And I think that's the next wave of automobile development.
You've been
driverless cars.
Watching the Jetsons again.
Not the Jetsons. I've been watching the Science Channel. But anyway, that's a ways away. That's a whole other topic. You're not going to be – the world would be – I don't think the world would suffer greatly if people pedaled more bicycles than cars, but obviously I'm in no position to say that. I did ride a bicycle across the United States once, and I do depend heavily on a car every single day of my life. So, you know, there you go. Those are the facts, whatever they are.
Okay, gentlemen. completely out of time. And we didn't get to even the funnest part of the program, but there's always next week. John, are you much of a doomsday prepper?
No, much to the chagrin of my friends, I have no interest in it.
Perfect. All right.
By the way, Simon, there's no such word as funnest.
Or funniest.
Okay, there you go.
Peter, I want to thank you for putting up with us for another Sunday. It has been a great discussion.
You guys teach me more than I could possibly imagine. I'm learning more every day, and I'm starting to think about going out and buying guns. That's honest to gosh truth.
Simon, can I ask you a question?
I knew that John Perry would have a bad influence on you.
No, it's not a bad influence at all. It's a good influence. It's the world as we know it. No doubt about it.
Hey, Simon, what do you think of the San Francisco nudity law?
Is it now enforced? Everyone has to be naked in San Francisco?
I think they overturned the law, and now public nudity is banned.
Well, good.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it. Yeah, I mean, there are some good-looking naked people, but there are lots of not very good-looking naked
people.
Yeah,
the most I've seen by far.
Yeah. I'm in no hurry to walk down the street and see a bunch of naked people. No, thank you.
But, Carmen, I was going to say, look at the bright side. If nudity's permissible, you might be able to qualify to park in the handicap section.
Okay. And I'll respond with, and there'd be no place to hide a gun.
That's true. Good point.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Oh, it could be.
Excuse me. I'm just trying to ascertain whether or not you have a firearm. Would you please take off your gloves? I think I'm going to use that one.
Okay, gentlemen. Time to wrap this up. I want to thank you both and Sam Moffey, who took off to have something, not quite sure what. And of course, a big thank you to our missed friend, Manny Barling. Manny, get well soon. I can't deal with these people anymore. Till next time, this is Simon Parrott wishing everyone a happy and safe week, day, and we'll be back next week.
Good job, Simon. Take
okay.
care,
thank you, everybody. Take care.
Bye.